welcome to Thought Crime. Today's date is 29th of May, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is the second episode of our new series. I say our because I have a co-host here with me, the esteemed author of Legal, Truthful, Guilty, Mr. Sam Melia. Sam, how are you doing, sir? How's life treating you?
I'm doing well, thank you, man. Yeah, it's, I've just got word that I'm getting the car back from the garage today, so that's just in time for me to get back to work on Monday.
Oh, nice. So have you not been back? Have you been working since you got released from your license then? Or
briefly, I did, yeah, from about summer of last year to around Christmas time. And then the work just kind of dropped off a cliff, but thankfully the book kind of came out at the right time. So that's kind of bridged me until work started back up this summer. But yeah, the clutch had gone on my car and I was just holding off until I heard that work was going to be coming back in before I pulled the trigger on actually getting it fixed.
Well, it's good to hear that you've still got work that you can go back to. And I'm very pleased.
Yeah, well, it's all via the guys in our local kind of PA community. So
even better.
That's another. I know, yeah.
Even better, Nationalist Community helping you out. I'm not sure if we even mentioned the book last time. It is an excellent book. I do recommend people read it. It's a riveting read, actually. Like, you don't want to put it down. I was reading it, and I knew that I had to stop reading because I had other things to do, and I was just continuing reading it. It's a very enjoyable read. It's very, very well written. It's quite similar to the experience that I had. You can put it up there along with David Irving's book, I think, as well, which he wrote while he was in prison, which I think is
high praise. Thank you.
Yeah, it's meant to be high praise because it is a very good book. Today we're going to be looking at something similar to a book, not quite a book, a white paper, David Lammy's white paper on youth justice, which is outlining the proposals that the Labour Party are making to deal with the youth criminal problem. And a lot of it is to do with race. And of course, David Lammy is a very good advocate for black people. I'm certainly not going to knock him for that. He certainly does the right thing there. But there is no balance to that. Nobody is pointing out the opposite side to this, effectively. Nobody's putting the white voice out there to explain why there is this different racial disparity that there is with crime. So we're going to be getting into that today. We're not going to go through the whole white paper because it's massive, 100-odd pages, something like that. What I've done is I've pulled out select quotes from it, and we'll stop after each quote and we'll have a bit of a discussion about it. Do you want to add anything to that, Sam, before I begin?
No, I'm just glad we're not going through the whole thing because, yeah. These white papers are very long.
Yeah, I saved you the bother of doing that. I went through it all myself and just pulled out the quotes and then sent you the quotes to look at. Well, it starts off with David Lammy making an introduction to the paper. And he says, "As a young boy growing up in Tottenham in the 1980s, I saw too many young people, often black boys like me, take their first steps towards trouble. Many were pulled towards violence and criminality without anyone stepping in to change their path. By the time the state noticed them, it was already too late. When we fail to intervene early enough, the consequences can be devastating. Not only for children, but for victims and entire communities. Around 80% of prolific adult offenders first entered the justice system as children. If we want fewer adult offenders and fewer victims, we must intervene earlier and more effectively, support children before risks escalate or signs of harm or offending first emerge." And you look at that and you think, well, they want to intervene earlier. That's good. You want to prevent crime. But what they really mean is we mustn't put them in prison. What he appears to be saying is if you put young people in prison, they then, when they become adults, 80% of them also end up going back to prison. So to prevent that, we must stop putting them in prison in the first place, which is shocking, isn't it, really, that they could come to that conclusion.
Like, when are we supposed to start putting them in prison then, Lammy? It's like if they're doing crime at a young age, that's where you end up. It's like this idea that it's like, oh, we have to step in. It's like, no, the prison is the punishment. It's like that's what happens afterwards, and that has to be there. Once you take away that the after effect of crime, then I mean, at that point there's no deterrent at all. And this idea that it's like, yeah, these communities are being disproportionately affected. It's just it's madness. And it's like, oh, we just need more spending, more state intervention early on. And it's like, how about we just, well, I mean, ideally, we just wouldn't have them here. And then the problem would be solved at the source. I was arguing with someone on Twitter the other day, and a bunch of other people jumped in, but they were talking about the Emily Jones thing. And I think she was beheaded by some like schizophrenic Albanian. And their retort was like, well, we need to be spending more on like community services and care at home and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, this is all just increased cost for increased risk that hopefully it doesn't happen. And it's like, well, surely the first thing would be to just not have them here. And then all that increased cost and increased risk that goes on afterwards just isn't there.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? If they weren't here, these crimes couldn't possibly take place. If we didn't have Muslims in the country, then who knows how many hundreds of thousands of white girls would not have been raped by the grooming gangs. I mean, Sarah Champion's estimate, I think when she was Labour MP, was it could be up to 1 million white girls. That's why I say hundreds of thousands.
I think she'd confirmed like 100,000, and then the kind of commonly cited rape statistic is basically that only 10% of them are actually reported on. Therefore, you can times any sum of by 10 in order to get the kind of reality. And we know obviously there was a huge amount of cover-ups and complicity in these things. So whatever the official figures are, yeah, we can assume it's multiple times that.
Just to add another point to that, Rupert Lowe has succeeded in getting a debate on the grooming gangs. I think it takes place in the Houses of Parliament on Monday, just related to that point. But getting back to this issue here, I mean, there's also evidence to show that crime goes in families. If parents are criminally minded, then the children will be criminally minded, the grandchildren will be criminally minded. It's not necessarily poverty that causes it. It's just a sort of mentality. It can be hereditary, just the same as an ability to play musical instruments is hereditary. Criminality is also heredity. And if it shows at a young age, and the state ends up putting them in prison, that can only be because they've already caught them dozens of times for other offences. Or they may know that they're guilty of these other offences, but they don't have the evidence on them, so they then punish them for a lesser charge. And I mean, this has gone on for centuries that they've done this. I mean, even when they went after Al Capone, I think they settled for going after him for tax evasion on alcohol, even though they knew he was guilty of all these other offences, but they wanted to get him on just one of them. And these are some of the reasons why these youngsters get sent to prison. But of course, they don't address that at all in this white paper. Continuing, he says, the lessons emerging from the Southport inquiry following the tragic murders of three young children by a violent 17-year-old known to agencies. And we should add to that as well that there was dozens of other young children that were maimed and seriously injured. It was absolutely horrific. It's still being kept from us what actually went on. I mean, it sounds like these three young children were actually beheaded by him. I mean, it's just, it's impossible to imagine what those children went through, the survivors. And because they haven't been public about it, they haven't had any help from social services or from the council because of this anonymity thing. So the families of the ones that were murdered have had help, and obviously they're public and you can see who they are. But the ones that didn't go public because they wanted to protect their children, they've actually had no help from social services. I was looking at that the other day. So and this is being brought up here, this Southport inquiry, and we know that one of the reasons why he wasn't pulled up on this before is because he was black, and the headmistress was told, don't forget there are racial disparities in black children that get referred, and it could be that you're just discriminating against him and seeing him as a black person with a knife. So once again, it was the fear of being called racist that was the reason why Ruda Cabana was not referred to these agencies. That does not get brought up here. David Lammy says the lessons emerging are a sober reminder of what can happen when systems are not sufficiently coordinated or decisive. in the face of escalating concerns. We must learn those lessons, and this government is determined to act. And it's about four or five times now that they've had inquiries into horrific things that have gone on. And it's because people have been fearful of being called racist that this wasn't properly investigated. But according to David Lammy, it's because the systems weren't sufficiently coordinated or decisive. And bear in mind that the whole point of this paper is to say that we shouldn't be putting these people in prison. And here you've got one that nothing was done about it whatsoever. If he had been put in prison for having a knife on that bus when the police caught him with a knife, then these girls would not have been, you know, they would still be alive, wouldn't they? Any thoughts on this, Sam, or the what happened at Southport?
No, yeah, it's exactly that. And it's this idea, like I say, there's been multiple inquiries and they all call for more transparency and all this kind of thing. And all that seems to do is reinforce this idea that disproportionate numbers of, you know, BAME communities being targeted for prison, for arrests and all this kind of thing, that needs to be fixed. And on the ground, what that looks like is a head teacher having a black student caught with a knife and being like, well, I don't want to contribute to the statistics, so I'm going to let this one slide, and I'll let the next one slide, and the next one, and then, oh, he stabbed someone. And this is happening up and down the country. You know, while I was away in the probation hostel, one of the black guys was telling me about his, I think it was his nephew, was up north in a school there. And he had brought a knife into the school and had the intention of stabbing one of the other students. And it just so happened that it fell out of his pocket and the teacher saw it and picked it up. And, you know, whether that led to anything, I don't know. But it's like this is happening in these communities, and things like carrying a knife and taking retribution against, you know, people who maybe called you names, maybe scuffed your trainers violently is kind of par for the course, and it's not the way we work in this country.
Well, there's also that incident with Valdo Calacane when he murdered three people, went on a rampage, and once again it was the reason why he hadn't been sectioned is because they said, oh well, it's a disproportionate number of black males that end up being sectioned, so we don't want to section him because we'll be accused of being racist. Exactly the same reason why this headmistress didn't report on Ruda Cabana. And yet there's no mention of this being the reason for the, or one of the contributing factors to why these horrific things take place. David Lammy continues. He says, our approach is rooted in what works. Evidence shows that relying too heavily on custody, once behaviour has escalated, creates more adult offenders, more crime, and more victims. More than two-thirds of children released from custodial sentences of less than 12 months go on to reoffend within a year. So he's saying that he is literally saying that it is because we're putting these children in custody that they are then going on to become criminals. And it just beggars belief that
so
he could believe that,
isn't it?
Yeah,
so backwards.
I mean, I met somebody that was in jail, and they actually got jailed when they were about 16 or 17, and he said this was actually the making of me, and I'm really annoyed at myself for ending back in here in my 40s. And he said that having that short, sharp shock when he was younger put him off ever going back into jail again. And he was actually in there. It was a business thing. It was a drugs business that he was running, basically. But he had no intention of going back in there. But you could tell that he had discipline, self-discipline, and he'd worked on improving himself. He came from a very poor area, but he was highly intelligent, highly fit. And he credited going to prison as being similar to when kids go to public school. He said it knocked some sense into him, basically. So that was a white person that went to prison as a child. What they're saying here is these black children that end up going to prison as a child, they end up going to prison again within 12 months' time. And it effectively says that they are problem children, doesn't it? And that they are correct in putting them in the prison. Not that it's the prison itself that makes them turn to a life of crime. They've already turned to a life of crime. And also, as I pointed out earlier, they would have been found guilty of multiple crimes before they actually put them in prison. You know, they don't just put them in prison for the first offence.
No. And with the culture that is present in these communities. It's like time in prison in youth offenders institutions and everything like that. It's merely social credit. You know, it's nothing to be ashamed of, and it's, if anything, it lends you more credence within that community. So of course they will go on to reoffend.
Yeah, there is that issue as well, the way that things are looked upon in certain communities. And of course they admit this, they say black people don't trust the police, but it also means that they will do whatever they can to protect people from their community from being even arrested by the police. I've seen instances where the police are trying to chase a black criminal and there are other black people standing around, standing in the way of the police so they can't get to them. Whereas traditionally, I mean, a policeman used to have a whistle and he would blow the whistle and white people would know that there's a criminal trying to escape or whatever, and they would all try to jump on him and catch him for the police. So we've gone from that to the complete opposite. Now we have multiculturalism.
Yeah, and it's affecting us as well. And I'm hearing from a lot of people in you know, the white communities that I'm in, that it's like if they saw police chasing someone down or in trouble or whatever, they wouldn't be jumping in to help, because police are now being seen as an enemy force to us as well. And, you know, the recent murder of Henry Nowak is indicative of that, where we see the police as not an ally of the community, but an ally of other communities and willing to watch us bleed out in handcuffs.
Well, it seems if you just tell them that you've been the victim of a racist attack, that's it. You know, you don't have to check the other person to see whether they've been stabbed, even though they say they've been stabbed. I mean, that's absolutely horrific.
Well, I mean, he'd literally been slashed in the face as well. So to even look at him, you would know that he's obviously come off worse of this racist attack, and definitely wouldn't warrant handcuffing.
I'm wondering how old he is as well. I mean, I think the killer was only early 20s, something like that.
Yeah, Nowak was, I think he was only 19 or 20. He'd just started university.
It's incredibly saddening, that. It's quite emotional to think about what happened with that young lad dying there. And yet this is one community, the Sikh community, they're allowed to carry ceremonial knives. So if they're allowed to carry ceremonial knives, why aren't they blunt? If they're ceremonial, they don't need to be used for anything, do they? So they're ceremonial. Mm-hmm. Why do they not have blunt knives if they have to carry these things around? And I've seen video today of this young Dikwar, and he's like jumping around with two metal blades, and he's doing stabbing motions against somebody else. And it was a martial arts weaponry display, and I think it might have been for an MP or for a councillor, and it was outside in Southampton, and they all had serious weaponry that they were using. And I just thought, you know, what would happen if white people were to get together and do a weaponry display like that? I mean, they would all be jailed for being terrorists, wouldn't they? But if you're Sikhs, apparently you can do that in public. You can just get these weapons out. It wasn't a reenactment. It was genuine weapons that they were using. And, of course, after doing that, he then stabs this Henry Nowak. It's horrendous, that. Getting back to these quotes here, he says, David Lammy says, "That is why we are setting an ambition to reduce the number of children remanded to custody by 25%, backed by £5 million for community placements and enhanced bail support. We are also considering wider reform to move away from ineffective short custodial sentences for children by raising the minimum term for detention and training orders, while ensuring custody remains available for the most dangerous offenders. Alongside this, we will strengthen parenting orders so there are real consequences for parents and carers who willfully fail to support efforts to address their children's behaviour." So there's two points here, really. If he says 25% less child criminals will be locked up, that means 25% more of them will be on the streets. And the second point is, instead of saying, look, this Southport attack would never have occurred if it wasn't for the government's immigration policy, they're trying to sort of excuse it and say, well, no, what we'll do now is we'll have consequences for parents that don't punish their children. And I mean, I can imagine the parents saying, well, look at the state of the society that you have put our children in. Look at what you're teaching them at schools. Look at what's on the television. Look at the way they're all addicted to mobile phones and what's on the internet. And then you're expecting us to be able to control them. You don't even have discipline anymore in schools. And yet do you see what I mean, there, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, what are these real consequences for parents even supposed to be? It's like, are we fining them? And it's like, well, that just increases the poverty, which supposedly is such an effect on the criminality. You know, it's like, I mean, what can we do beyond fining them for real consequences? You know, we're going to jail the parents, put the children into care. That's going to increase criminality. It's just, it's these ideas that are just thought up by like a Lanyard class where it's like, oh, this will solve it. And it's just like, how is this going to work on, you know, when the rubber meets the road, like the Rudy Cabana parents, how are they supposed to address the fact that their son's like obsessed with knives and carrying them around everywhere? You know, short of locking him up, at which point it's like, well, the state should do that. It's like, just lock the kid up, man. It's really, really bizarre. And it's just, again, more and more costs to hopefully mitigate the risk. And when the risk manifests itself and one of these attacks takes place, what's the solution? Well, according to Lammy, it's more spending and less jail time. And it's like, this cannot continue.
What did the state do when they did find him with a knife on the bus? Well, they didn't arrest him. They just walked him home and said to his parents, be more careful where you leave the knives in the kitchen. I mean, what are they supposed to do? Put a padlock on the kitchen drawer?
He's a 17-year-old. He can reach the top shelf.
Yeah, it's ludicrous. I mean, what you could do is you could say, well, these parents could be deported for this, on the same lines that the people that facilitated the grooming gangs and didn't report them to the police, they should be deported. I mean, that's Rupert Lowe's policy. That's why he was reported to the police and kicked out of Reform, is because he said all the people that facilitated that means the families that didn't report them to the police, that knew about it, that we can show knew about it, they should all be deported. So if you've got parents that like these Rudy Cabana's parents, but I mean, that's what they should be doing, deporting them for allowing this to happen. But again, if it wasn't for the government's immigration policy, none of these things would be happening because these people wouldn't be here. Getting back to David Lammy, he says, we will carefully consider whether the age of criminal responsibility, currently set at just 10 years old, still reflects modern understanding of childhood vulnerability and development in today's society. And, you know, it's set at 10 years old. If they raised that, then the killers of Jamie Bulger would not have been prosecuted. And we see these horrific crimes that take place with younger and younger children that are carrying out these crimes. And he's saying, oh, no, well, we need to raise the age of criminal responsibility, which would mean that, you know, these 14-year-old rapists wouldn't be prosecuted. I think that this recent incident that we had with these gypsy rapists, three gypsy rapists, 10 charges of rape that they were found guilty for, and they didn't even get a prison sentence. That's because they're under the age of 16. This is David Lammy's policies in action. You had the same with an Iranian rapist a couple of weeks back, raped, I think, a 15-year-old girl. He was 14, no prison sentence, has to have lessons in consent. Basically, I mean, I would say that the way that the world is now, we should be reflecting our modern understanding of childhood, which is that a lot of these children are no longer children. They've been forced into an adult world from a younger age. And if they're capable of doing things like murder and rape, they're capable of going to prison in the same way that an adult would be punished. You shouldn't be saying, well, we need to raise that age, easier for them.
Yeah, it's like when I read that bit, it's like, oh, you could take that either way, really. Either we're going to lower it or raise it. And it's like, it would make more sense to lower it because, like you say, these kids are reaching a kind of maturity far younger than they were previously. And we are now seeing kind of really grim crimes, sex crimes, murder and stuff like that. It's like being committed by younger and younger elements of this society. So, yeah, the idea of raising it, it's like, but again, it's all just in service of less people or less people from these communities going to prison. And it's like, this isn't a solution. This is merely just plastering over the problem and hoping for the best, which just hasn't worked for the previous few decades. And it's not going to work now.
You have to view this through the lens of David Lammy. I mean, he's the equivalent of a black nationalist. I mean, he will be trying to enact policies which will benefit his community. And rather than thinking, well, it will benefit my community to have these criminals taken out from it and put in prison, he's thinking it will benefit my community if they're not actually put in prison in the first place, because then they might not turn to crime. So I mean, you've got to understand that that's what he's motivated by, is doing what is best for black people. White people should be the same. We should be motivated by what is best for white people. So you have to bear that in mind. So I think this is...
And it's not even like a eugenic kind of best for black people, where it's like, you know, lock up the criminal element, and then it's like those who propagate forward from that point will have less of that kind of criminal gene or anything like that. It's completely dysgenic, where it's like, we're just going to just let more and more people out, and it's just not punish crimes and everything. And it's like, good for the black community in what way? It's like, it seems very nice, but it's like the actual reality on the ground is like things are just going to get worse and worse for the black community.
Well, it shows you his thinking's disjointed, really. Yeah, but I do think he's trying to do what's best for black people, but he doesn't really understand properly that what this would result in is more black victims of crime. Next, he says, we will also pursue the removal of serious, violent and sexual foreign national youth offenders where it is safe to do so, whatever their age, and the Home Office have introduced legislation to bring in a new youth diversion order to tackle the increasing number of young people being brought into the criminal justice system for terrorism offences, allowing agencies to intervene before risks escalate. So again, there's two points there. We're going to remove violent and sexual foreign national youth offenders. Excellent. They're going to remove them. They're going to deport them. And then it says where it is safe to do so. Well, if it's a Muslim country and you're sending somebody there who is a sex offender, the Muslim country will hang the sex offender. This is why they don't send them back to Afghanistan or Pakistan or anything else, because they will be hanged there. So it's not possible for them to do this. I see this all the time. They say this offender will be eligible to be deported. Well, he won't be deported, because they'll just say, well, the country isn't safe for them to do that because they have the death penalty there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also, it's like, what is it? You're going to deport a 14-year-old by himself? It's like, come on, this is never going to get past any sort of court. Like, they're just going to block it on just the face of it. It's just, it's ridiculous. You know, like you say, you know, Jamie Bulger's killers were 10 years old. And it's just like, well, we're seeing crimes of that age now, of the same kind of egregious level. You're not going to be deporting them. Like you say, we can't deport the adults, let alone the kids. It's like, are we deporting the whole family? You know, it's just talk. It's like, you're never going to do this.
Yeah, it's just trying to appear as if they're strongly against this, so that they would deport these foreign offenders, but they won't.
Yeah, it's just like red. It's like red meat, isn't it? And it's like we're all just supposed to swallow it up and be like, oh, cool, they're getting to it. And it's like, but just the slightest bit of thought about what he's proposing here just shows that it's like this is going to be completely untenable.
And the second point here, where he brings up young people being brought into the criminal justice system for terror offences, well, a lot of the time they're autistic or they've got Asperger's. I mean, I've lost count of the number of times I've seen under 16-year-olds that have been brought into the criminal justice system and accused of terrorism for ridiculous things like having a pencil drawing of London with a nuclear bomb over it, as if they're literally going to get their hands on nuclear weapons and blow up London. Kids with 1488 written on the shed that they go out to alongside, like, no girls allowed. Literally just kids doing silly things and saying silly things in chat rooms as well, and using racial slurs. And, you know, kids fantasize about things. They're not aware of, you know, what the consequences of their actions can be. They all want to outdo one another in a chat room. And if you've got a member of MI5 in that chat room, they go after them. They shouldn't be put into the criminal justice system. They shouldn't be put in prison, but they have been. I mean, it's horrendous. And they've said that more and more children are effectively becoming terrorists, because what they're classing as terrorism is just saying silly things in chat rooms. I mean, it's there was one of them, I think the Sonnenkrieg division, and the actual leader of the group, when he started it, he was 11 years old and he was from Finland.
11 years old?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Do you remember when Hope Not Hate would post their, you know, their year in review or whatever. And it's like Sonnen Creek Division was always like really high up there. And then, yeah, they eventually nicked him. And it was like, oh, yeah, he's a kid who's running it. And you do wonder, it's like, who was beneath this kid? Like, was he never on voice chat or something like that? You've got like 30, 40 year old weirdos or whatever taking orders from a kid in Finland.
Yeah, they literally made chat rooms into terrorist groups where kids were fantasizing. He continues, he says, this white paper also addresses the inequalities that continue to shape outcomes across youth justice. Children with care experience remain dramatically overrepresented. So too do black boys, both in custody, but also as victims of serious violence themselves. We cannot build a fair or effective youth justice system while ignoring the persistent racial disproportionality within it, including the continued adultification of black children compared with their white peers. Taken together, our reforms represent a meaningful step towards addressing the disproportionality by making the system fairer, more consistent, and preventing escalation into offending. And what they mean by making it more fairer, they mean making it so that not so many black people are locked up. And the way to look at this is to say, well, if you look at men and women, about 99% or 95-99% of all crime is actually carried out by men, and only like 1-5% carried out by women. Does that mean we need to make the justice system fairer? And instead of locking up 90% of the men, we should just let them out on the streets? Well, no, of course not, because men are more likely to commit crime. What these figures show is that black people are more likely to commit crime. That's what the figures show. They don't show that they're racist
right.
judges.
That can't be right, Sven. Surely not. Surely it's just racism within the system that's causing these higher statistics. You know, and maybe it's misandry within the system that's causing all these men to go to prison and women to remain free. It's so ridiculous.
Well, they appear to be saying that the police are all racist, the judges are all racist, that they're just picking on black children who aren't guilty. I mean, it's saying that, well, they must really be innocent. Well, of course, they're not. I mean, you can't argue against these figures. I've gone to...
what are we constantly seeing on social media and stuff? It's like we're constantly seeing these judges letting off minority criminals for things that white people would definitely go to prison for. You know, it's we're seeing this constantly. So the system is trying its hardest, and still these statistics are raising their heads, and that's the uncomfortable thing for them. So it's like, all right, we've got to try even harder and actually, you know, put it into law and rulings and everything that we're going to have a 25% drop in order to kind of start to level the playing field a bit.
Yeah, it does. It just means putting more black criminals on the streets. I mean, you say then about we see it on the news about these judges letting these people off. As I say, there's been two very high-profile cases, these gypsy children that were let off and this Iranian that was let off as well for raping. I say let off. I mean, let off without a prison sentence, effectively. Now, I've gone to J. Philippe Rushton's book, Race, Evolution and Behaviour, which I do recommend that all our listeners have a read of. It's an excellent book. It's there's a condensed version of it, which you can read, and it goes into details about all the actual statistics that there are out there. And I've got some quotes from him that I'm going to be using today. And this first one comes from him. It says, blacks are 12% of the American population and make up 50% of the prison population. In the United States, one out of every three black men is either in jail, on probation, or awaiting trial. That is much more than the number who graduate from college. Chapter 2 in this book shows how this racial pattern in crime is found worldwide. Interpol yearbooks show the rate of violent crime, that's murder, rape, and serious assault, is 4 times lower in Asian and Pacific Rim countries than in African and Caribbean countries. And that's because there's a big difference. White people come somewhere in the middle. If you look at things like crime, it'll say that Japanese commit the least crime, white people commit an average amount of crime, black people commit 4 times as much violent crime. That's the difference. That's the reason why we have these disparities. And he talks about adultification there. And this is another interesting one. It's effectively people seeing black children as older than their actual age. Well, there's good reason why people might see a black person as older than their actual age. And again, this comes from J.P. Rushton's book. He says, the faster pace of growth among blacks goes on through childhood. Black babies have greater muscular strength and can reach for objects better. Their neck muscles are often so developed that they can lift their heads up when they are only 9 years old. Not, sorry, 9 hours old. And I remember being really shocked when I read that. I remember
holding babies. That's insane,
yeah. You have to hold their head up, don't you? Black babies,
yeah.
9 hours old, they can hold their heads up. In a matter of days, they can turn themselves over.
What are they reaching for? They're reaching for the knives.
Black children sit, crawl, walk, and put on their own clothes earlier than whites or orientals. These findings are measured by such tests as Bayley's Scales of Mental and Motor Development and the Cambridge Neonatal Scales. Blacks reach sexual maturity sooner than whites, who in turn mature sooner than orientals. This is true for things like age at first menstruation, first sexual experience, and first pregnancy. One study of over 17,000 American girls in the 1997 issue of Pediatrics found that puberty begins a year earlier for black girls than for white girls. By age 8, 48% of the black girls, but only 15% of the white girls, had some breast development, pubic hair, or both. For whites, this did not happen until 10 years of age. So that's a big difference between 8 years and 10 years. The age when girls began to menstruate was between 11 and 12 for black girls. White girls began a year later. Sexual maturity in boys also differs by race. By age 11, 60% of black boys have reached the stage of puberty marked by fast penis growth. 2% have already had sex. White boys tend not to reach this stage for another 1.5 years. Orientals lag 1 to 2 years behind whites in both sexual development and the start of sexual interest. So this adultification, this looking at black boys and black girls as if they're older than their actual age, I mean, physically they are. Physically, they mature quicker, up to two years quicker. So you could be looking at like a black boy of the age of 14, and he might actually look more like 18, I guess, because a 16-year-old can look like they're 18. And, you know, these are one of the reasons why they say, well, it's not going to work if we just put them into the community. They're too much of an adult for that. Look, he's got a beard. He's got a full beard. He's got big muscles. He's, you know, he's not the same as a 14-year-old white boy would be.
No, I mean, you look at 14-year-old white boys, they still look like kids. You know what I mean? And it's like you see the girls are obviously maturing faster than them. So you see these like weird, say like by schools or just out and about or whatever, and you have like this boyfriend girlfriend pairing where the girl looks about 18 and the boy looks he's about 12, but they are the same age, they're in the same school year. You know, these things are just facts of life, you know, in terms of race and evolution, and to try and legislate around it is just ridiculous.
Well, it's pretending that race doesn't exist, isn't it? It's pretending, no, that can't be true. They all got to be the same at the same stage of development at that age. Well, no, they're not. There's 2 years difference. That's a massive difference when you think of the differences there are just between one particular racial group. Some 14-year-olds will look much older. Others will look much younger. But if you think there's a two-year difference between that, between blacks and whites, that's the reason for this adultification. You know, that's the reason why somebody would look at a child as if they were older than they are, is because they effectively are. He continues, the number of children in custody has fallen dramatically over the past two decades, from more than 3,000 to fewer than 400 at any one time. Well, this either means that in the past two decades, 2,600 were jailed when they were innocent, or that 2,600 are now not jailed today for the same serious crimes. I mean, it's amazing to me that they could look at that and think that that's it. That's a good thing. We've dropped from 3,000 to 400. Well, is there less crime? Is there less youth crime now? Well, no, there's loads more youth crime now. We've got a massive knife problem.
That's the whole reason for this whole report, is because it's like this is happening too much. But apparently, yeah, it's the people in custody has fallen. And it's like, and then apparently still, even with it falling, the disproportionality is still there. And it's like, well, doesn't that tell you something? It's kind of baked in. It's always going to be there.
Yeah, and it's not like we're saying like all blacks are criminals. It's just that there is a higher proportion of them that will turn to criminality than amongst white people. And again, even amongst Japanese and Chinese, there's a lesser percentage of them that will go on to commit crime than white people. You know, and this is the same on lots of different scales and measures, as we were seeing there about the developmental index. It's also with fertility, crime, IQ. You can always have, like, it will have Japanese at the bottom or at the top, white people in the middle, and blacks at the bottom or the top of whichever statistics you tend to look at. Children from ethnic minority backgrounds, and black boys in particular, continue to be disproportionately represented at almost every stage of the system. So as you just pointed out there, Sam, even though there's 2,500 less of them being sent to prison now, black boys continue to be disproportionately represented. Black children, who make up just 6% of the 10 to 17 population, represent 9% of arrests, 12% of sentences and cautions, and 26% of custodial remands. And
that's mad.
22% of the youth custody population. So it's basically four times as much as their percentage of the population, which is effective. Mm. That's the same wherever you find black people, effectively.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, yeah, it's... It's just a constant. We just seem to be working so hard to make sure that that isn't the case. And it's like, we're just going to have to make peace with this, this is all just it. We're working so hard against it, and it's still happening. And the victims of this are the people who have these crimes committed against them. And still, yeah, I mean, God, from to be 6% and represent 26% of custodial is so wild.
Yeah, and the victims are predominantly black victims as well. It's blacks mm-hmm. that suffer the most from this. And you're saying, you know, we need to make peace with this. We do. We need to talk about it. We need to have a discussion about this. We're putting so many resources into trying to combat this problem, and we're not identifying the cause of what they see as a problem correctly in the first place. They're saying it's racism that must be to blame for this. Well, as we pointed out, it's not... misandry that is to blame for males being more likely to commit crimes than females. It's just a fact of life. And that's why it's important, I think, that we have conversations like this, but nationalists point these facts out. I'm saying what I'm doing is we're pointing out the opposite view to this so that you can get a balanced view of it. You can hear David Lammy's side of it, and you can hear the nationalist side of it. As I say, David Lammy is pro-black, and obviously we're pro-white. So and hopefully you could get to...
We're pro... Pro-reality.
Yeah, reality, that's it, pro-reality. Blacks make up just 4% of the population in the United Kingdom. I've got another quote here from J.P. Rushton. In the United States, blacks are less than 13% of the population, but have 50% of all arrests for assault and murder, and 67% of all arrests for robbery. 50% of all crime victims also report their assailants are black. So the arrest statistics cannot be due to police bias. So this is important, because this shows that it's not racist police, because the victims of crime also report the same statistics. 50% of their assailants were black. The same pattern is found in other countries. In London, England, blacks make up 13% of the population, but account for 50% of the crime rate. And this book was written about 20 years ago, so obviously that's increased now. A 1996 government commission in Ontario, Canada, reported that blacks were five times more likely to go to jail than whites and 10 times more likely than Orientals. In Brazil, there are 1.5 million Orientals, mostly Japanese, whose ancestors went there as labourers in the 19th century, and they are the least represented in crime. So it's just a fact that some racial groups, ethnic groups, are more prone to committing crime than others. And once we admit that, you can look at making policies which are going to help them, because the people that would be most helped by putting more black criminals in jail would be the black community themselves, because they would be less likely to be the victims of these crime. I mean, white people are victims of black crime much less than black people are victims of black crime. So I've never understood this idea with Black Lives Matter. Oh, we need to defund the police because they're arresting black people. Well, they need to arrest more black people, and then the black community would be a lot more safer, wouldn't they, really?
Yeah, and we saw that in those areas where they basically held down a kind of thing where it's like, right, we're not going to have police in this area. Police didn't go to that area, and there was just murders and rapes going on. And this is something that, again, the white community, we would never propose this idea that it's like, yeah, you need to arrest less white people. It's just like, no, take criminals off the streets. It's, you know, it's like now we've got a... You know, whites in Britain calling for the death penalty to return. It's like, no, stiffer sentencing and harsher punishment.
It's almost like spare the rod and spoil the child. And I think that, you know, that goes on into adulthood. You have to have punishment for wrongdoing. Getting back to David Lammy, children from Gypsy, Roma and Traveller backgrounds are also overrepresented across the system, and we are seeing a rise in the overrepresentation of mixed heritage children. Biases including adultification bias, where black children in particular are perceived as older, less vulnerable and more culpable than their peers at key decision-making points, is likely to contribute to this overrepresentation as children move through the system. Well, I would say that they are actually a little bit older and they are less vulnerable and more culpable than their peers because they're about 2 years later in their development. So yes, that does likely contribute to the overrepresentation, but not because of the fact that the people dealing with them are imagining them to be much older than they are, that they actually are much older. And this bit here, Gypsy, Roma and Traveller backgrounds are also overrepresented across the system. That's got to be one of the reasons why that judge the other day didn't send the Gypsy rapists to jail, even though they'd been found guilty 10 times because they were 14 years old.
Yeah, and that's something when I was in Hull prison, like there was a lot of people of traveller background there. And again, the culture plays a part where it's like going to prison isn't any sort of negative stigma. It's merely seen as kind of like that's just part of what we do is go into prison. So there's no kind of shame for the family or anything like that. It's just part and parcel of their culture.
Yeah, that was the same in the prisons that I went to. There was a large sort of traveller grouping there, and they were all cousins, and they're all related to one another, basically, yeah, in different parts of the prison. Racial disproportionality is not only an issue of system contact, but an issue of safety. Black young people are around six times more likely to be victims of homicide than their peers. Some young people face a far greater risk of the most serious harm, and that is not acceptable. But what David Lammy is proposing will lead to even more black people being the victims of homicide, because the people that carry out the homicide or are likely to carry out the homicide are on the streets instead of being put in jail. And this is, as I say, I mean, it's the point that I was making earlier, but I mean, he understands here black people are more six times more likely to be the victims of homicide, six times more likely to lose their lives. I mean, that's a pretty horrific figure there. But the answer isn't to stop locking black people up, is it?
You're just going to get more. It's like, and just having those two things, it's like six times more likely to be murdered. And then it's like, and they're also six times more represented in custody. And it's like, these things match up, Lammy, you idiot. It's like, yeah, you absolute simpleton. Yeah. It's like, you know, but to reach these two or find these two separate conclusions and then go, it's like, ah, clearly there's a problem here. And it's like, no, this makes complete sense.
Yeah, you also have to bear in mind, I mean, he has civil servants. It's his civil servants that will be telling him this. I mean, it's not old Lammy's idea, this. It's what the civil servants have told him after going through training.
He's putting his name to it, isn't he? I mean, if someone came to me with those statistics and then went, it's like, so we're going to make this report where we need more table tennis clubs, I'd be like, well, I mean, this seems to be self-solving. Six times more likely to commit crime, six times more likely to be in custody. You know, jobs are good, and as far as I'm concerned, but instead it's like, no, we need to lower the custody, which will inevitably raise the homicide rate, won't it, Lammy? It's like, it's just no critical thought here whatsoever.
Yeah, you should be pointing it out. I haven't heard anybody else on the opposition pointing this out either. I haven't seen anybody on Reform or the Conservatives pointing this out. It's just common sense.
If Restore started quoting J.P. Rushton and stuff like that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, that would be excellent. Yeah, I would be very pleased with that. Continuing, and as I say, this isn't actually from the introduction. This is from the main part of the white paper now. It was earlier. I should have pointed that out earlier. He says, this government is committed to driving this step change in all areas going forwards. Child knife possession offences should only be met with a charge, a youth conditional caution, or in select cases, a deferred prosecution, which will be available in all police forces to ensure a non-criminal outcome where appropriate. So no more jail for black youth caught with knives. That means anybody under the age of 16 caught with a knife is not going to be sent to jail. They might get a conditional caution or in select cases, a deferred prosecution, but no criminal outcome.
It's like, this is just, come on. It's like you're carrying a knife. It's like there's intention there. And then all these things, you know, conditional caution, deferred prosecution, whatever. It's like nothing to actually physically stop that same youth carrying a knife in the future. And, you know, it's only by basically pure chance, you know, the stop and search laws that they absolutely hate and want to reduce, that allows them to get caught with it. But, you know, next time that same youth is going to be carrying the knife, he's not going to get stopped and searched and carry out whatever attack that the intention was.
Well, it also means that Rudy Cabano, when he got caught with the knife on the bus by the police, the same thing would happen. He wouldn't get referred. He wouldn't.
So what's even changing? You know, it's like, yeah, you weren't sending them to prison before this report, and now you're saying it's like, oh no, we're going to really make sure they don't go to prison.
It's like they've learned nothing at all. The tragic, and you've mentioned Southport as well in the same section. The tragic events in Southport demonstrated the devastating consequences when risk is not taken seriously, information is not shared, or action is delayed. A system that allows responsibility to dissipate as concerns escalate is a system that fails in its most basic duty. He's correct that the system has failed.
You just said you weren't going to take the risk seriously and you were going to delay the action.
Yeah.
So it's like, what are we doing?
It's just beggars belief that they can put these sentences together when they're doing the opposite. Bring up Southport and then say, well, we're not going to charge these kids when they're caught with knives into jail. It says the lottery is not only geographic but also demographic. Evidence indicates a pattern consistent.
The lottery, just,
yeah, it's a lottery.
It's
all chance. It's all just by luck that these black children are getting arrested.
Police go out there, roll a dice, and just, oh, I guess I'm nicking this one today. It's like,
The lottery is not only geographic but also demographic. Evidence indicates a pattern consistent with structural biases, including adultification, contributing to black children being disproportionately less likely to be offered diversionary interventions or receive the same level of support as white children for the same offences. So he assumes that because there is these differences in the statistics, it must be a structural bias. And as I was saying, that there are other reasons why this could be.
But at the same time, it's a lottery, so it's also random. So it's like, if it was random, surely we'd see, you know, kind of like coin flips. You know, you'd see an equal number of tails and heads come up over a long enough time frame. And it's like, but here we're calling it a lottery, but clearly there's outcomes are coming down on one side way more than the other.
Yeah, in pretty much in the same sentence, he's actually saying that. I mean, some of these reasons why this will happen, as I say, you've got black children that are two years more advanced in their development than white children, for a start. Plus, you've got previous offences to take into account. So if there have been lots of previous offences and somebody hasn't been prosecuted for that, that can be the reason why they're being prosecuted for it. Blacks also are more likely to plead not guilty, which I think is because they don't properly understand the justice system, not just that they don't trust it. And that can be a reason why they get sort of more of a punishment, because they plead not guilty to something that it's quite obvious that they are actually guilty for. And there's also the fact that the police might know that they are guilty of lots of other offences, but they haven't got the evidence to go after them on that. So they'll go after them with the evidence that they do have, which is on maybe a lesser offence, and then they'll get punished. So these are all other reasons that they could be. It doesn't have to be a structural bias. If there is a structural bias, why can't he identify what it is and show us some statistics to prove that? Because the statistics that he shows can prove my point, and they can also prove his point. And this is the issue with this. There are two sides to this, and we're only being told one side to this. I mean, I can remember being young and not nationalist and hearing, black children are arrested far more times than white children are. They're stop and search far more times than white children are. And you instantly think, well, that's not fair, is it? You know, you don't think much further than that, that it's not fair. And that's effectively what level David Lammy is at. It's like, oh, well, that's not fair. Rather than thinking, well, what could be the reasons for this? Don't just assume that the police and the authorities are racist and they hate black people, because the opposite is the case in most instances. In most instances with white people anyway, because white people fall over themselves not to appear to be racist. Further, we know that individuals from an ethnic minority background, and black people in particular, are less likely to make an admission of guilt, often due to lower levels of trust in the police and the wider justice system. This can limit their access to OOCRs that require a formal admission of guilt, creating disparities in who benefits from diversion and increasing the likelihood of children from ethnic minority backgrounds being escalated into formal criminal proceedings. And
well, as we all know, they didn't do nothing. So
That's it. They will always say that. Even though there's lots of evidence. I mean, what you could also say is that, well, it shows that white children are more honest. You know, they admit their guilt more often. That's another way that you could look at this. I think it's not, well, they don't trust the police, they don't trust the justice system, and it's not because it's racist, it's because they don't understand it. They never developed a justice system for themselves. I mean, what used to happen in Africa, one village would go out and rob the other village, and the village that had been robbed, would just go out and rob another village, not necessarily the one that had robbed their village, and they would just be robbing one another's village. Like, and they didn't have a justice system. I mean, this comes from like early studies in Africa, Negroes in Negro Land, I think is the book that I'm quoting from, where they discuss this. And I think
straight back to jail with you.
Well, I'm quoting that. That's quoting a quote. I'm not using it to call people that. I'm just reading out the quote from a book. And it's a book from the 1850s when it was a quite acceptable word to use. It's still an acceptable word to use in a scientific sense. But effectively, it shows that they didn't understand justice. Why would they understand the Western justice system? They never developed juries. They never developed a prosecution and a defence. And they just see it as, I might get found guilty. If I plead not guilty, there's a 50-50 chance I might be found not guilty. And if I plead guilty, there's a 100% chance I'm going to be guilty for this. So I'm going to plead not guilty. And I think that's the way they look at it, in a very, very simple way, because they have difficulty with abstract thought. And again, you can tell that from the African languages. If you look at the Zulu language, for instance.
Even having like just justifying their own crime. So it's like, say you did commit a homicide over something fairly trivial. If you felt that was worthy of homicide, you would stand on that kind of like, no, I'm not guilty because he deserved it. And it's like, that's not how, like, we have a higher principle of justice where it's like, you don't get to kill someone for something relatively trivial, but for them you do. So it's like, yeah, like I say, they just don't understand what we mean by justice compared to them.
I think that's a very good point. And I've seen that, read about that actually happening. And there was an instance a while back, and a black guy thought that the white father was being threatening towards him. He flipped out, pulled out a knife, stabbed him multiple times, and he said in the court he saw him as being a threat to him, and he just that was his response. That was his natural response. They don't have such good impulse control as other races. Again, that comes from statistics. So this not understanding justice, thinking, well, justice is that I should be able to hit him back if he's taking something from me, and that's justice, whereas that isn't the way that we have justice in the West. So again, cultural
proportional response. Yeah, it's that proportional response just isn't there. I know there's been a lot of writing on kind of like this Indian kind of honor system, where it's like if you're kind of publicly embarrassed by someone else, then it's like people feel justified in killing that person. And it's like all this just so, you know, quite literally foreign to us. And our justice system is just like desperately trying to keep up with these changing cultural attitudes towards these things.
Yeah, very, very different systems of justice throughout the world. Again, just to get into that point there, I was saying about abstract thinking. If you look at Zulu language dictionary, there are no words for any abstract ideas in there. And there's also there's no words for differences in time, like yesterday, tomorrow. There's just today, which shows you that that's the way they think. They think differently. So to understand something complex, like putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, understanding that somebody else would have been harmed or hurt by whatever it is that you did. I mean, in the way that they would look at it, well, it's not me that's been harmed. Why is the state punishing me for this? When I didn't harm the state, it was this other person that I'd had an argument with. He's the person, like, I had an argument with him. Why are you now, the state, punishing me for it? That's not fair. Do you see what I mean? It's a completely different way of looking at things. And that's going to lead to a mistrust in the police. But it's not that the police are racist. It's that they have difficulty understanding our justice systems. The average number of children on remand in custody has decreased over the last 5 years. Again, that means they're out on the streets. However, we are still seeing some custodial remands for relatively minor offences, such as minor drug offences and theft. And it is disproportionately black and mixed heritage children who are remanded to custody. 28% and 18% of the remand population respectively. And again, I'll point out that in a lot of cases, this is because the police know they are guilty of lots of other offences, or they may have been in trouble for lots of other offences and not sent to prison or not remanded. That's why they get remanded for what appears to be a minor drug offence. The same thing happens in America, where you have plea bargaining and you'll have somebody in jail on a ridiculous minor drug offence, and they plead guilty to the minor drug offence because there wasn't enough evidence to get them on the multiple other offences that they were actually guilty of. So, I mean, that's just something that happens with the justice system. But again, the civil servants, David Lammy, they don't understand that. They see it as this must just be the people that are dealing with them are white racists. In His Majesty's Inspectorate of Probation thematic inspection of youth remand to custody, it was judged that 46% of the children assessed could have been safely accommodated in the community instead. This indicates that some children are being locked up unnecessarily at one of the most formative points in their lives. I don't think it shows that at all, because they're not, they're not including the fact that these children might well have been guilty of lots of other offences before that, before they were locked up. It wasn't just that they were being locked up for this one offence. In most cases, I think that would be the case. Any thoughts on that, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, again, it's this lanyard class making an assessment that almost half the kids could have been safely accommodated in the community. It's like, we got any hard proof of that? Because I think we're going to find out if you enact this kind of stuff, that it's going to be a lot less than 46% who are going to be safely accommodated. I think there's going to be a lot of repeat offence, and there's going to be a lot of harm that comes from this.
We have a few quotes now that can all be answered with that. I mean, previous offences are possibly the reason for this. Remand is an area where we see significant racial disparities, with black and mixed heritage children more likely to be remanded to custody than their peers, even after controlling for demographic and offence-related factors. The London Accommodation Pathfinder provides supported accommodation and wraparound support to predominantly ethnic minority children. Insights from the pilot point to locally tailored, community-informed, robust alternatives to custody, effectively diverting ethnic minority children from custody. I mean, so what they're effectively saying there is, we set up this alternative to custody, and it's proved to effectively be a way of diverting ethnic minority children from custody. I mean, they don't show that they're less likely to offend afterwards. They just say, well, it showed that they're less likely to go to prison if we put them in this, not in prison, effectively. Statute and long-standing youth justice principles are clear that custody should be reserved for only the most serious offences, where no other sanction is appropriate. However, this is not always reflected in practice. In 2024-25, the average custodial sentence length was just 18 months. And in the 3 years from 23 to 25, custodial sentences were sometimes imposed for offences such as possession of cannabis, 7 children, offences relating to theft of a motor vehicle, 34 children, driving whilst disqualified from holding or obtaining a licence, 7 children, all offences which, without reference to individual cases, you could reasonably expect to be managed in the community with effective supervision. Again, my answer would be there must have been lots of other times when the same people had been managed in the community with the effective supervision, and it obviously hadn't solved the problem because they're still stealing cars. I mean, stealing a car, driving it without a license, you would expect somebody to go for prison for that, especially if they're kids.
Yeah, and it's like, what, you're catching all of these kids on the first time they stole a car? Come on. It's like, no, there's been a spate of car robberies. You finally caught them. And so you can do them for one car robbery. But, I mean, that's the kind of thing that is notorious for not being prosecuted because you can't find who does it, you know? I mean, I've had vehicles stolen in the past and just nothing comes of that. No one gets nicked for that. I think I had a motorbike once, and I think the only thing that was found months later was the frame. Everything else has been torn off it, and it's like we managed to track it back to you because of the number on the frame. But you know, no one's arrested or anything like that. So yeah, if you know an area is having a spate of motor vehicle thefts, and eventually you pick up like a 16-year-old who's stolen a car, then it's like, well, probably. It's reasonable to assume that it's like a lot of the other thefts in the area have been committed by the same kid because he's got the tools. He's very quick at doing it. Like this isn't his first time.
Yeah, especially if there's circumstantial evidence to point that he's done it before, but they don't have enough evidence to actually take him to court and prosecute. Now, if that would be the reasons why somebody would then be taken to court and given a custodial. Custodial sentences also apply disproportionately to some ethnic groups. Analysis by the Youth Justice Board found that even after controlling for demographic and offence-related factors, black children were between 2 and 8 percentage points more likely than white children to receive a custodial sentence rather than the alternative community sentence, a youth rehabilitation order. Well, that I would say that that's very probably because the person dealing with this did not think that they would respond well to an alternative community sentence. I mean, and these are people that have been trained in anti-racism. They're going to be doing everything they can not to put the black children in custody. If they do put them in custody, I would say they probably have a good reason. We know that short custodial sentences are not effective for children or for public protection. Again, what metric are they using here for this? I mean, they're off the streets for that amount of time. The public are protected for that amount of time. So surely they are effective. More than 2/3 of children released from custodial sentences of 12 months or less in 2023 went on to reoffend within a year. Just over 1/3 of children sentenced to community sentences during the same period were proven to reoffend. Yet around half of all custodial sentences imposed on children in 2025 were under 12 months. I mean, this is correlation, but it's not causative, is it? And the fact that the ones that they send to prison are more likely to reoffend once they release, the ones that were just given community sentences during the same period were not proven to offend just, you know, so much. So that's effectively saying that the people involved are accurately making an estimation of the criminal there. They're saying that this person is a career criminal. He needs to go to prison. And then when he comes out of prison, he goes and commits crime again. They look at somebody else and they say, well, this person has taken a few of the wrong turns in life. He hasn't had a lot of luck. We're not going to send him to prison. We're going to give him a community sentence. And he doesn't go on to reoffend. I mean, that, to me, it says that that's being accurately done. But according to this white paper, it's saying, well, no, that means that if you put them in prison, they're going to go on to commit more crimes. So we'll just not put them in prison at all. That's the answer.
Yeah, it's just the system appears to be working relatively well, and it's just not satisfactory for them. And they're doing this kind of chicken or the egg thing, where it's like, oh, it's the custody that's causing the crimes, and it's like, well, no, they did the crime before the custody. The fact that they reoffend, I mean, you know, we've both been to jail. Like, neither of us want to go back, but for these children, they're like, it's like, oh no, that was fine. I'll roll the dice again on whether I get arrested. It's beggars belief, really, this whole thing.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't want to go back there. I don't want to go back there. I mean, I cope with it well, I think. And some positive things have come out of it.
But we both came across people while we were in there who were having essentially a good time while they were in there, and it wasn't having a major negative effect on their life. They weren't missing the time outside, really, because they were in there with family and friends. So it's like, and like I say, yeah, no negative effect. They come out, they go right back to the illegal work that they were doing. All their funds were held by the family and everything. So there's really no negative to it. You know, new connections are made, new things are learned in jail, and these youth offenders institutes, from what I've heard, The kids in them are just really, really rough, and if anything, they're more grim than the adult jails, because the adults at least have some maturity about them, whereas these young offenders, there's like a kind of cavalier attitude and a kind of quickness to violence.
Yeah, they're more dangerous, the young offender institutions, and people don't want to be on even on a wing with too many of these youngsters on there, because they are the ones that are likely to cause the trouble. And criminality, it is highly inheritable. So this is why you get families on there, and the families are all involved in crime, is because it is heritable. And that is, you know, that's just something that we have to deal with. In the past, we had a death sentence for relatively minor crimes. And if a young person committed one of these crimes, they'd get a death sentence and they wouldn't reproduce effectively. And that managed to weed out a lot of the most sort of violent people in society from actually breeding. Now we no longer have the death sentence. So a lot of these people, they just sort of continue breeding. And the best you can do is just take them off the streets for a certain amount of time. You can't look at it and say, well, it's because we've taken off the streets that they're committing crime in the first place. I mean, they've, as you point out, Sam, they've committed the crime first of all before they were convicted. So one of the problems is that, well, they are going to learn from others while they're in prison. And, you know, that's just an issue that has to be dealt with. We do have to have this criminal system.
I mean, they're going to learn from others regardless, aren't they? It's like either you send them all to prison and they learn from each other, or they're not sent to prison and they're all out in the community learning from each other. Again, it's one of those things that's going to happen no matter what. And it really, the custody, all it does is serve to protect the society. And instead we're deciding to endanger the society.
Yeah, by leaving them out on the streets. For children from ethnic minority backgrounds, this package of reforms is intended to make the youth justice system fairer and more consistent. Nearly 10 years have passed since the Lammy Review, yet persistent racial disparities undermine trust in the system and risk entrenching disadvantage rather than supporting children to move away from harm. Addressing racial disproportionality is central to this government's vision of a modern youth justice system that commands public confidence and delivers better outcomes. Who does it deliver a better outcome for? Well, the black child criminal, certainly not his victims, or the victims, that the future victims that there are likely to be by leaving him out on the streets. I mean, what they mean by fairer effectively means, as we pointed out, it'd be the same with men and women. If they said, we'll need to stop locking up 95% of men to make the system more fair and more consistent, so we only lock up the same amount of men as women. And that's the logic that's being put there. And you're just ending up putting the public at risk. As I say, I think David Lammy, really, he's at fault here, because he is trying to do the best for black people, but he's been misled into thinking what's best for black people is allowing the black criminals on the street, which isn't going to be better for black people, because vastly predominantly, the victims that they're going to have are also going to be black. It's a black community that will suffer.
It's interesting because it's like you've got to think, it's like, is he hoping to return to his kind of black constituents and be able to say, you know, X number haven't gone to jail and we're also seeing a drop in crime, but that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing an increase in crime. So it's really, it's very short-sighted and like a kind of a quick win for him, I suppose. But it's like, you know, this is 10 years on from the Lamy review. In 10 years' time, are we going to readdress this again, find the statistics are still the same, you know, in terms of like adult custody levels, except we also now have a lot more youth crime and we just kind of postponed taking them off the streets for however many years until they kind of cross that 18-year barrier. And then we're like, oh, we can try you as an adult now. And you've got this long list, like this huge rap sheet of their kind of like delayed prosecutions and community orders and all this kind of stuff. And they just carried on doing it. And I mean, what it says there, this package of reforms, one of the things from Lamy's review in 2017 was basically the various elements of the justice system. They were told to either explain or reform. And how can the justice system in this current age explain honestly why these disproportionalities are there? It's like you can't, because you have to start quoting J.P. Rushton. You have to start kind of being honest about race. So it's like none of these elements of the justice system are going to do that. So their hands are tied. They essentially have to reform in this manner, because to do otherwise would be, well, it'd be thought crime, wouldn't it? It'd be speech crime. You couldn't possibly address these things as they have to be addressed.
They would have to admit that they got things wrong, and they won't do that. So they'll just keep going in this. They'll keep going in this direction. I mean, they did the same with universities as well. They either had to explain why it was that they didn't have so many black pupils in there, or they had to reform by having diversity quotas and putting black students in there who don't actually have the exam results to get put in there. I mean, it's the same all across society. But the most dangerous part of it, or one of the dangerous parts of it, is criminal justice system. Other dangerous parts of it, I mean, could be putting them in positions as airline pilots, air traffic control, where we've seen problems with diversity in air traffic control in America. President Trump spoke about that when that happened. Putting them in as engineers, anything that's really, really important, you need somebody there but on merit, not somebody there who's just been put in there because of what race they are. And we're certainly not putting people in prison just because they're black. I mean, I hope we've outlined some of the other reasons for these statistics today, but we shouldn't have to do this. You know, the opposition in government, you know, the Reform Party or the Conservative Party, they should be pointing these things out. I mean, we're not.
Yeah, I mean, there needs to be an adult in the room there and just going, it's like how have we got to this point where there's a huge white paper written about disproportionality in convictions when the reality is just staring us in the face? You know, it's like every week it's just like news story after news story from these kind of heavily diverse areas of kind of like mass theft, murders, drive-bys. And it's like, and you know, we've seen societies like America, which have a much higher black population, that see exactly the same statistic kind of ratios. So it's like if we sit seeing this all over the world, wherever these people are, it's like an adult just needs to stand up and go, it's like maybe this is just the reality and this is just how things are, and we can either deal with that honestly or we can kind of run around the bush making white papers and ideas for reforms and all this kind of stuff, and making reports like this one, which seem to contradict each other a few paragraphs after the previous one. It's mental. And this is why people have no faith in this system and just kind of want it to collapse, is because it's like everyone feels like they're losing the damn mind. You know, they can look out the window and see what's going on. And then to have Lamy come out with this review compiled by a bunch of civil servants and with his name slapped on it and going like, this is actually the problem. It's mental. And this can't continue, because like I say, 10 years ago, the Lamy Review saw it was like 25% is in custody and we need more transparency. 10 years on, it's now, oh, it's 26% are in custody. We've got the transparency. We can see the stats. And the result is that actually we need to just arrest less of them. And it's like, great, okay, well, I'll see you in 10 years then when that statistic is still going to keep ticking up as the population increases, except now we've got even more crime on the streets. Thanks, Lamy.
Yeah, the only way they've been able to actually get the crime down is to stop arresting people for other crimes like shoplifting, burglary. Mm. I mean, so they'll say, well, the crime figures have gone down. Well, they've stopped investigating crimes. I think it's something like only 2% of crime that gets reported ever gets solved. And my main criticism of the David Lammy report when it came out was that he did look at these other countries and he said, look, you know, they've got a racist problem as well. But he should have gone to Africa for the control group to see what the crime statistics are in Africa. And then he would see whether it was racism that was causing this in these white multicultural countries. Because if you get the same crime results in Africa as you get in Britain and America and elsewhere, then it can't be racism because you haven't got white racists administering the justice system in Africa.
We're seeing a 100% black incarceration rate in Niger. So really, we're actually doing pretty well at only 26%.
Yeah, you could point that out. The other thing is, I mean, I hope that people don't think we're anti-black people at all, because what we're pointing out here would benefit black people to hear this and to their communities. They would be less likely to be the victims of crime if the opposite of this was actually done. And I think, black people that heard us would see that, you know, we're not being against black people by what we're actually saying here. It would make life better for them as well as making life better for us. And it's just that, you know, this stuff needs to be pointed out. Anyway, I think we'll leave that there for now. Sam, thank you very much.
That's
for
good to me.
Yeah, we'll discuss this Belgium case next time. And I think we've also got something to talk about with left-wing protesters now being called political prisoners by the left-wing media. We'll get into that next time. So thank you for coming on, Sam. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks' time, and I hope you all have a great weekend ahead of you.
See you, guys.